It was during the second term of George W. Bush that the White House Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships Office identified five cities across the country that were in dire need of healing from violence. Richmond, California, had been identified as one of those cities, and one of our finest local service, social service agencies, STAND, an organization that works tirelessly to end domestic violence and help rebuild the lives of those affected by it. STAND applied for and received a $35,000 grant as part of this program. And the call then went out to all those in the Richmond community who would be willing to work on a multi-year project to offer a healing process for victims of violence. One of those first responders was a deacon of the Episcopal Church, the Reverend Mary Hintz. Mary, a lifelong resident of Richmond and active in several organizations that care for and work with people in Richmond, was a deacon of the Episcopal Church at Holy Trinity, La Santissima Trinidad, in Richmond. Because both of her advocacy and concern, she joined this task force that was now quickly faced with the question of, how in the world do we do this? Their first thought was to educate clergy and congregations in the Richmond area. It was a good idea. But then someone remembered a crucial first step had been missed. Talking with those who have experienced violence themselves and asking them what they might need and want. And so the members of the task force began to speak with people in the community who had suffered trauma and loss in their lives and were in the process of healing. And every single one of them said, "We need to tell our stories. We need to tell our stories." And so on June 18th of 2005, there was a workshop called Healing in the Heart of Richmond. And Mary Hintz, deacon of the Episcopal Church, led a workshop to begin this process, a workshop on lamentation. It was in that workshop that day at New Faith Cathedral in Richmond that she was reminded of the power of lament, especially in the process of healing. Because as the event unfolded, Mary and others discovered that without lament, without the catharsis that can come out of telling our story, out of crying out to God, healing is hard to come by. What they found was that this first step in the healing process involves just telling the story, telling people what had happened. It was only in this process of telling the events of that night or the details of that day that Mary and others could help people begin this process of healing. And the second aspect of this healing was forgiveness. Being able to forgive was essential to being able to heal. Even if the person in pain did not know who to forgive, as some of these crimes against their loved ones had never been solved. The third piece along this path to healing they found was to become active. To become an activist, to help others who are similarly suffering. They found that as they began this work of empowerment, they were able, so that if this pain was visited on someone else, there would be a community ready to take them in, a place for them to heal. And it all began with sharing the stories of lament. Lament. Lament is one of the most visceral and yet often forgotten elements of faith. Were it only that faith in God was an inoculation against pain and suffering in this world. A glance around this room today, though, tells us otherwise. And so begins the book of Lamentations that we heard this morning. How lonely sits the city that was once full of people. In this book, the people of Israel are in nearly unspeakable pain and grief over the destruction of their holy city, Jerusalem, in 587 BC. The Babylonians have overcome the defenses, and as we've heard about these last few weeks from the book of Jeremiah, desolation is at hand. And so they begin to tell their story. They're calling out to God of their suffering. Indeed, some have called this the book of how. In a rhythm scheme that was often used for funerals, the author of the book of Lamentations offers up the pain visited upon the holy people of Israel, and sometimes in graphic detail. And yet what is so powerful about this book, and powerful about all in lament, is that whenever we lament in our lives, we expect a response. We would not come to God calling, crying, if we did not expect a response in return. For in lament, we believe that even if we find ourselves in the valley of the shadow of death, God will hear our call. And so we cry. Being in a place like this, it's not hard to understand why the disciples are imploring Jesus to increase their faith. What is more difficult to understand is Jesus' response when he replies, "If you had the faith the size of a mustard seed, you could say to this mulberry tree, 'Be uprooted and planted in the sea,' and it would obey you." So let's get this straight. The disciples approach, fearing that their faith will not be sufficient, and Jesus mocks them? Is he really saying that if they had just this much faith, they could uproot trees, maybe move mountains? Actually, I do not believe that is what is at work here. What I believe Jesus is pointing the disciples and us towards is the kind of faith that is not material or substance, but is about faith, about relationship. You see, the disciples are asking for an increase in faith, as if it were a substance, something that can be measured and quantified. But Jesus responds that if faith in God was about substance and amount, if that were its framework, if that's how you want to think about it, if you had just this much, a mustard seed, a poppy seed's worth, then you could do unbelievable feats. But it's not. That's not what faith is about. Jesus says, it's because your request, apostles, is a category error. That's not the nature of faith. Instead of asking for more faith, remember who you have faith in. Remember with whom your trust lies. Find that relationship once more. Or in the words of 2 Timothy, know the one in whom you have put your trust. The other day I was in conversation with a recently ordained deacon of the Episcopal Church. And at their ordination, a longtime family friend who had no connection to the Christian church at all was there that day in support. And at the reception, this friend came up to this newly ordained and minted deacon and said, "Okay, so from paying attention to that service, from the prayers and from the sermon, I think that now you are a deacon so that you can go and make me a ham sandwich." Right. Ask just about any deacon, and they will tell you that that joke, or one slightly varied from it, has been made to them more times than they would care to count. And due to parts of the scriptural witness and elements of historical precedent about the diaconate, a great deal of our contemporary understanding of what a deacon is has to do with service and table service at that, hence the ham sandwich. I mean, there is some reason for this. In the early church, we have evidence that deacons were involved closely with the care of those in need, especially with food for widows and orphans. And in the early liturgical rites, the deacon is often found at the table, as well as collecting the needs and cares of the community to bring forward, for instance, as prayers of the people. Unfortunately, though, as the understanding of the diaconia, the ministry of the deacons, was modified, often to our great detriment, we as a church have lost sight of the radical power that lays within the heart of the diaconate. Because even though our ordination rite is clear that deacons are to assist in public worship and in the administration of God's word and sacraments, there are two other elements that precede this duty. The first is service in the world, which is clearly seen in Mary's action with those in need of healing from violence in Richmond. Again, from the ordination rite for deacons. You are to make Christ and his redemptive love known by your word and example to those among you with whom you live and work and worship. This is what deacons for millennia have done among the lost, the last, and the least. This is what deacons of this diocese do every single week as they serve in homeless shelters and food pantries, in hospitals and prisons, both in the Bay Area and around the world. Here's the catch, though. Often, this is where we as a church are most comfortable, allowing these courageous folks to do this work on our behalf. But there is another aspect of this ministry that is all too easy to lose sight of. And it has something to do with the word diakonos itself. At the time of the writing of the New Testament, there were several meanings of this word from which we understand what a deacon is. And one of the more common meanings, which we often overlook, of diakonos is that of messenger. Hermes was known as the diakonos of Zeus. In other works, the rainbow was thought to be the path from heaven of the messenger Iris. A deacon, then, is also one who bears a message. And this is an element of the diaconate that we as the church lose sight of at our own peril. Again, from the ordination of a deacon. You are to interpret the needs, interpret to the church the needs, concerns, and hopes of the world. The needs, concerns, and hopes of the world. Just as the deacon is to bear the message of this good news to the community, at the same time, the deacon is asked to interpret, to bear the message, the needs, the concerns, and the hopes of the community, to bring those back here to the church. But will we answer? Just as Mary brought with her the truth of lament, and like every lament in the Psalms, the hope of God's answer to those healing from violence in Richmond, she also bears with her to us the lament of the world in which we live. Since that day in 2005, Mary continues to hear laments. As part of GRIP, the Social Justice Committee, as part of GRIP, she hears the lament of the community in Richmond on a monthly basis. And so there is an opportunity for her to bring to us, the church gathered in this part of God's creation, on Cedar and Spruce, in North Berkeley, in the East Bay, in the great state of California, and the United States and North America on this ever-warming planet, Mary, as a deacon, can bring to us the pain and sorrow, the needs and concerns and hopes of this world, that we might respond. Just as the teller of the story in the book of Lamentations expects a response from the Lord. Otherwise, they wouldn't lament. When the deacon interprets the lament of the world to us, the world expects a response. Good friends, what will our response be?